gravitational magnitude at the surface as a function of the mass of the planet. Some of those planets spin fast, some of them spin slow, and one of them spins in the wrong direction. Does that mean it makes negative gravity? Of course not. I don't think rotation is required for there to be gravity. If by some magic you could stop the Earth from rotating, I think you would have the exact same amount of gravity. Rotation is not required for gravity. On top of that, the electrons going around the nucleus of an atom, that doesn't change as a function of cryogenic cooling. The temperature of something is translational kinetic energy. Those electrons going around that nucleus have the exact same charge, even though they're cryogenically cooled. The nucleus has got the exact same charge, even though it's cryogenically cooled. Therefore, those electrons are in the exact same orbit, I believe. So that doesn't get changed. And by the way, just because you've made something superconducting, let me drop it. Just because you made something superconducting doesn't necessarily change its basic nature. In order to sense superconductivity, you have to apply a charge, voltage, current, and sense the fact that there's no voltage drop. Before you apply a voltage there, you would never know it. I mean, an Allen Bradley resistor has a property you and I call resistance measured in ohms. And if I cryogenically cool that resistor, and if it happened to become superconducting, I'll admit its number of ohms would decrease. Ohms really, in that case, really is the electrons that want to travel through have an occasional impact, and they don't get a free passage. And when it becomes superconducting, those free electrons, get a free passage. They don't have those impacts, so to speak, that slow them down. That's one way of looking at it. And we call it low resistance. But until I apply a voltage across it, I don't know that. The new person joining us, go right ahead.
What's the mechanism?
Darn good question. I think there's lots of theories as to what is superconductivity, and I'm not sure that they're really sure.
Maybe the orbits are getting closer to the engaged atom.
That's a speculation, but we don't know that. A person with a comment, give us your phone call and your name, and then go right ahead with your comment.
ECQYT, if I understand it, when it comes to superconductivity, it comes down to the vibrational energy of the individual perigees with the atoms of the material, and that vibration is quantized to a level of energy below that quantized, you know, that first step up to the quantized, you know, to be the first quantum of vibration, then essentially that substance has no vibration in it. What that vibration ends up doing, electrons go firing through, end up running, and it essentially increases the effect size of atoms in the substance. And so it has that level of, that minimum level of vibration, and it provides a much easier path for the electrons to go through.
Yeah, that's a tough one. Was there anyone else who want to make a comment on this? Give me your call letters right now.
Comment, attention.
Okay.
I had a comment, David.
Okay, we're going to take them in John and Wes in that order. John, I know you've been waiting for quite some time to make a comment. KC2WGV in the group, K2RIW. You think we're going to settle this one now, John? I'm a little worried.
Oh, absolutely, right now. First, I have two questions, one real simple one. Now, the effect of gravity, if the Earth slows down, I think objects would slightly increase because of the lack of centrifugal reaction or centrifugal force. So weight might slightly increase. I think about that. Now, second, a little thought experiment. I'd like to know what you and Eric think of this. Suppose we mount an electron gun in a sphere with the gun pointing to the center rotation at right angles to the axis. Now, if we had a detector there, a fluorescent screen of some type, and just the accelerating potential until it was just visible, had a detector in it, it would give us a reading. Took that and you up to a fantastic rate. Would you simmer? The thought experiment that brought back to you to KC2WGV.
And when you talked about people getting lighter because the Earth is no longer rotating, what about the guy standing at the North Pole or the South Pole? I don't think he's ever experienced that phenomenon.
No, I said heavier. Yeah, of course at the North Pole, but say, you know, at the equator.
One minute at the equator, he's going to get a little bit heavier. If he made the measurement while the Earth is rotating, where he's getting some centrifugal force. And operate this apparatus that you just described fast enough that you measure a difference in the
luminosity
of the target in the center of the sphere that's being rotated? I think the answer is yes, but now, would you be measuring mass, or would you be measuring effect of artificial gravity that we call acceleration? When I've got somebody in a centrifuge, most people call that artificial gravity because it's not coming from mass. It's coming from cyclic, circular acceleration. And now, is there really a cyclic, circular acceleration of the Earth that makes gravity? I don't think so. And the different gravitational constant of each of the planets is not because of their rotational rates, I believe. I think it's only because of the amount of mass they've got and the amount of diameter they've got and the mass distribution. But Wes is going to say on all this.
Well, Dick, just think about putting that rotating trough of the Earth. Do you think that, as we increase speed, would it get a burn?
They use that.
Somebody said they use that. Who said that?
No, I was throwing my call out there. KB2K, use it.
Okay, KB2K, use it. You're after Wes. Two extra hit, K2RIW. Go ahead, Wes.
But I afraid that you've qualified as common draft out of this object, because time goes on. You change, you get disruptive with this object, and then, like the last time, you're going to make a comment that you got to break me down, so I think it's forget it. It's too late. And trace you.
KB2KUZ, start with your name, sir, and then your comment. K2RIW.
RIW, KB2KUZ. Good evening, Dick. My name is Alex. The comment being, aside from acceleration, anything with a mass has a gravity. Mass will have a gravitational effect on anything next to it. That nothing to do with artificial gravity or speed or acceleration. Look at a test using a very sensitive scale like a gravitometer. Stack the two cubes side by side at a reading. Stack the cubes one on top of the other, you'll get a slower reading. Got to do with mass versus mass. KB2KUZ.
I believe I agree with you, Alex. Anything that has mass will be affected by a local gravitational field, the manner in which we usually call it a measurement that we call weight, but not necessarily. So I'm pretty much in agreement. Glenn seems to be saying that individual particles of an atom, individual constituents of an atom, protons, neutrons, and electrons, when separated from an atom, no longer have weight, though they still have mass. That's what Glenn is saying. Glenn is sort of standing alone on that one. Most other people in this discussion tonight seem not agree with that one. And though he may have some good references that sort of say that. So, as I see it, John, we've been pretty much stumped tonight. We haven't come up with a nice compendium opinion as to whether or not electrons experience gravity. That was the original question. I was a little worried. Do you have a second question that was submitted to the mailbag this week? And I think this lady requires the prize, John. KC2WGV, K2RIW, there, John.
I don't mind somebody charming that has such questions, but I don't want to be I'm going to go. I have one more question if you think we have time. It's on an antenna.
My favorite subject, I can't turn that one down. Go ahead, John.
Very good, Dick. In fact, it's perfect because you four measure antenna exactly about that. The elements, your directors, reflector, on a PVC pipe, which is exactly what he wants to do. Not the lanes and trimming them and have to play with the space. On the directors, tie them together. Also connect them to the director wire, or can he have them all standing on the PVC? So maybe you can get on that then. Good luck to you.
The opinion you're about to hear results of a few years of backyard experiments with Aggie-like structures on a ratiometry antenna range, outdoor range improvement technique. That was the article that was in, I think it was 1957. magazine. If you do a search, an archive search in ARRL for K2LAW, you'll find that one of the articles is entitled Ratiometry and Outdoor Range Improvement Technique. And in that technique, you'll see how I set up an apparatus where I can make very precise gauge measurements on a Yagi. I could resolve a 20th of a dB of gain increase or decrease. And you keep doing that with various kinds of tuning, and you end up with a very high gain Yagi, in my opinion. And I've also spent the last 10 years as a consultant building Yagis for particular clients that needed high-performance Yagis. Let me drop. And on that outdoor antenna range, I came up with a so-called insulated Yagi, where each of the elements go through shoulder bushings on the boom, or in the original design, they were mounted in plastic blocks that sat on top of the boom, held down with hose clamps, with tie wraps, okay? And many of the Yagis I built at 900 megacycles, 915, consist of sheets of copper tape mounted on the top of a sheet of plastic, and all of the integral directors, driven element, and reflector are not connected to each other. Don't have to be connected to each other. What is a Yagi? A Yagi is a series of resonators. Resonators are tuned to a higher frequency. We call them directors. If they're tuned to a lower frequency, we call them reflectors. If they're tuned to the resonant frequency, we call them the driven element. A Yagi is a series of resonant elements, usually dipole-like structures, not necessarily. Each of them has the right resonant frequency, the right internal Q, in other words, bandwidth, and the right position in three-dimensional space. That's what a Yagi is. It's a series of resonators at particular positions in space. Let me drop. And in the case of a long Yagi, what I call a long Yagi, one made out of 19 elements, and there is something called the RIW-19 Yagi, sort of invented on that outdoor antenna range, 1977, and along came a company, not me, that manufactured those antennas and sold a whole lot of them, quite a few thousand of them. Anyhow, the point is that each of those elements are thoroughly insulated in the boom, set up that array of directors, elements that are tuned higher in frequency, which really means at the frequency of operation, each of those elements acts like a capacitive device. Whenever you take a LC network, a resonator, and if it's a parallel resonator, and you tune it below resonant frequency, if it's a series resonator, tune it below resonant frequency, you end up with a capacitor reactance. You get a pure resistance at resonance, but at a lower frequency than resonance, you get a capacitance. So each of your directors, kind of capacitor in free space. As such, that radio wave that you're trying to listen to, that planar wave that started off at a long distance away, comes into the vicinity of your Yagi. How it starts hitting those directors, the capacitor reactance of those directors act as a slow wave structure. The portion of the wave close to the boom, as it's traveling down that boom, gets slowed down compared to the portion of the wave that's further away from the boom. That slowing down of the wave closer to the boom, thus slowing down of the portion of the wave further away from the boom, creates a concave wave front. From the driven element. The concave wavefront really means wanting to focus that wave down to the driven element. That's what a Yagi does. It's a slow wave structure with a particular velocity profile. That means each portion along the boom.
Repeater, time out.
Each particular position along the boom, in the vicinity of one of those directors, has a particular velocity constant. Now, the coax cable is made out of polyethylene cable. The radio wave travels down the cable at 66% of the speed of light. That's its velocity constant. Well, in free space, you can make a velocity constant out of these things called directors by tuning them off resonance in just the right amount. So this velocity factor along the boom, because each of your directors in a very high-performance Yagi, each of your directors has a slightly different length and in some cases a slightly different spacing. So at each vicinity along that boom, there is a particular velocity constant for the wave traveling in that vicinity. And as you plot velocity constant of the various elements along the boom, that plot becomes a curve called the velocity profile. When you set up the velocity profile just magnifying glass works by the exact same principle. It's Huygens principle in both cases. Let me drop on this one. It's unfortunate that whenever we're taught about how a lens does its focusing, we're always taught from the point of view of what's that called now? Refraction effect. I can't think of the name of the word they use.
Refractive index.
That's the right word, refractive index. They talk about the refractive index of the glass. In other words, the wave enters the glass at a particular angle, and it gets deflected by the refractive index a certain number of degrees. That's one way of looking at it. There's another entirely different way of looking at it. The magnifying glass is thicker in the center than it is at the perimeter. The magnifying glass has a velocity factor because the glass has got a certain dielectric constant. The light traveling through the glass travels more slowly than it does through free space, through a vacuum or through air. So therefore, the portion of this planar wave coming from the sun that hits your magnifying glass, it gets more slowed down in the center of the magnifying glass than it does at the perimeter. The slowing down of the wave in the center of your magnifying glass versus the perimeter creates a concave wave. Concave from the point of view of the focal point where you're going to be burning a hole in a piece of newspaper. That concave wave by, let's see now, it's Huygens' principle. The wave always travels in normal to the local phase front. You're creating a concave-shaped phase front wave by the slowing factor of the magnifying glass. So the pure slowing of the wave by different amounts in the center versus the perimeter of the magnifying glass, that, in my opinion, is a better way of explaining where the focusing effect comes from. To me, changes in velocity factor and thickness of the magnifying glass does a better job than talking about refractive index. Both methods of explanation work, but the slow wave factor, my opinion, does a better job. Therefore, a Yagi antenna, a log Yagi antenna in particular, really is a kind of a magnifying glass. It's a synthesized structure. It's a skeleton structure that acts like a magnifying glass. When you go to a low enough frequency, you don't have to have a completely solid chunk of material like glass. By the way, there is a whole antenna concept called the Koch antenna, K-O-C-H, I think is the spelling of the man's name, where you start off with a great big chunk of foam and put capacitive devices like washers. You put washers, you embed washers in this great big chunk of foam, and you make the density of the washers higher in density near the center of the foam and lower in density near the perimeter. When you do that, that chunk of foam with those washers gives a focusing effect. It's called the Koch antenna. And lots of those have been built, and they work like a charm. So your magnifying glass has some of that effect. Your Yagi has some of that effect. As you can see with a Yagi, can we drop this?
Think about those washers assembled in a collection.
About microwave antennas with lenses.
The washers are all smaller in size than the resonant. They are just metallic objects with a certain spacing between their adjacent washers. They are a capacitive device. Anything smaller in size than resonance is a capacitive slow wave structure. By changing the density of the washers near the center of this Koch lens compared to the perimeter gives you a focusing effect. I think that's the question you were asking, John. Back to you, John, on that one.
Yes, Dick, that's complete.
So the washers are not necessarily touching each other. They're smaller in size than the resonance frequency for the frequency you're operating at. And you probably could be doing it with strands of steel wool. I'm not sure, but I think you could. Yes. In fact, you could take a little bitty pieces of metal that are slightly smaller than resonant frequency. They're really dipoles. And you can distribute them throughout that chunk of foam. And again, you could get a focusing effect. So the focusing effect of a magnifying glass and the Koch antenna are very similar. Although it doesn't look it, a Yagi antenna operates by that procedure. But as you can tell, it is the resonance of each individual director and the position of it in space. They do not have to be connected to each other. In fact, it's better if they don't. That they don't have to undesirable things with no transmission line fed to it at all. And so a good Yagi design, or wave structure with a particular velocity profile, driven element called the dipole where you put the energy into, which gives you a good impedance match to your transmission line. After that, it is, in my opinion, the highest performance antenna that I know of, which requires, for a particular frequency region, a well-designed Yagi, minimum amount of materials, the minimum cost of materials, the minimum wind loading of materials, the minimum mass of materials, you near maximum amount of gain, amount of materials, you have to go a long way to find any kind of an antenna that can give you more bang for the dollar, more bang for the gram, more bang for the square inches or square feet of wind loading. You have to go a long way to beat that, and you can't do it. That's the good news. The bad news is that Yagis in general rarely exceed 3% of bandwidth where they've got high performance, unless you've done some other exotic things, which is one of the things that I've worked on. So, in general, an ordinary design Yagi in the vicinity of 3 or 5% is the bandwidth in which it has reasonable standing wave ratio, reasonable gain, and you're outside of that frequency region, and you lose both performance of gain and standing wave ratio. But you get a lot of bang for the dollar. And as such, they were heavily used during World War II for early radar systems. They're heavily used by ham radio operators, even at microwave frequencies. Let me drop them. So you now know a little bit more about a Yagi, why it's so good, how does it operate, and know the elements don't have to be connected to each other. Now, if you do, in my case, some of the Yagis that I built at 900 megacycles start off with a large sheet of copper tape in which I cut out the copper tape in such a way that there were very fat directors, very fat driven element, very fat reflector, all held onto, taped down to a piece of mylar sheet of plastic material that's just the support structure. And there is the equivalent of a boom down the center. In other words, I have to remove all the copper tape down the center of where the boom would go, so that in my case, the elements are electrically connected to each other. And that's done for an entirely different reason. By having a wide chunk of copper tape in the vicinity of what you and I would call a boom does something else. It is a kind of inductive shunt. It is a kind of, what's the word I'm looking for now? Another adjustment of velocity factor that when you make the boom made out of copper tape wide enough, different amounts of width of that boom in between the individual directors, we were just right. Now have the ability to move the elements a little bit closer together and still get the same tuning of the Yagi. In the particular environment where I had to design that Yagi, I was limited as to how much length I was allowed to have from front to back. And so a three-element Yagi, I was able to build it with less length front to back by simultaneously controlling the width of the copper tape that was in the boom vicinity. So that was width of the tape that was creating a kind of an inductive shunt. It wasn't necessarily done.
Repeat your timeout.
It was controlling the inductive reactance between the elements. It wasn't done to electrically connect the elements to each other. The individual elements can be floating in space. They don't have to be grounded. I think that was the general question. I know I flew in a hell of a lot of other information, but because the darn many people have trouble understanding where a Yagi comes from, lots and lots of people used to think that the individual elements of a Yagi are like the individual elements of a filter. A filter consists of a whole bunch of resonators connected together with certain coupling coefficients between the resonators. That's how you make a filter. And people used to think a Yagi was a kind of three-dimensional spatial filter. It is not a filter. It has some of the properties of a filter. It's limited in what frequencies over which it will respond, but that's not where the gain is coming from. The gain is coming from the magnifying glass-like focusing effect. A good Yagi, if your eyes operated at that frequency, you looked down the throat of a Yagi, you would have a rather large black circle in space, where that circle has a diameter considerably larger than the length of the individual elements. That 19-element Yagi that I built on 432 megacycles, each of those, let me drop them. Each of those elements are a little bit less than 12 inches long. Look down that boom, you'll see a 1-inch diameter piece of aluminum coping for the boom. You'll see a whole bunch of elements behind each other where they're all a little bit less than 12 inches long. Effective capture area of that antenna is 5.7 feet diameter circle. Think about that. Effective capture area of that antenna is a circle, a black circle in space if your eyes operate it at 432, 5.7 feet in diameter, even though it consists of elements that are only 12 inches long. 1 foot long elements make 5.7 foot diameter. That is a 5.7 foot diameter magnifying glass made out of a whole bunch of elements that are all roughly 12 inches long. That's the magic of a Yagi. AC2WGB, T2RAW, TechNet. Yes, it's called a Koch antenna, is one way of doing it. And the other way of doing it is out of a waveguide-like assembly, a whole bunch of waveguides with various lengths. So there's various lens-like microwave antennas. The Koch antenna is one of the ways of doing it. There's quite a few other ways of doing it. Which ones are you thinking about, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RAW? Another whole concept of building a lens-like antenna, which has a whole bunch of metallic rings, where as you look across the surface of this circular object, you've got ring-like areas where there is empty space and ring-like areas of metallic reflector. And the, what that antenna does is it represents the fact that we're transmitting from the horn, so to speak. The signal coming out of the feed horn is a spherical signal, and there are certain portions of that spherical surface that from the point of view of the signal you're trying to send in infinity, there are certain portions of that spherical surface where the wave coming out of the feed horn is in phase and out of phase. And if you put metallic blocking rings in the places where the phase is out of phase, and clear rings of material where it's in phase, now end up with a kind of focusing in effect. The device has only got 50% efficiency because you're taking half all the energy and blocking it with these rings. But that, I forget the name of that kind of antenna, but that's another kind of focusing effect antenna. Over to you, Eric. Is that what you were referring to? K2RAW?
I kind of described it.
I
would see them as,
horn on the top, reflector on the bottom. Is this a ground station antenna you're describing and this reflecting device in between? It sounds like a kind of phase corrector that you're describing or a kind of secondary focusing device. There's a zillion ways you can put a so-called lens in front of a horn in order to give a more desirable amplitude taper, aperture taper across the parabolic surface. Maybe that's what you're describing, Eric. Over to you, K2LAW.
No, I probably wasn't clear in my description. That would be a tower. At the top of the tower, there would be a fat deflector which is 45 degrees. That would make 90 degrees from the equilibrium gap. Then it would pass through a very sharp bandwidth loop and then goes into a dish that turns to the top and boils it away. The pulp would seal it to that. Smoothing.
Watch water, doesn't it, Dick? It sure does. That so-called Fleischwanner is what it's called. It's also called a periscope antenna system. You've got a flat, almost flat, sheet of metal at the top of the tower with an elevation angle to that sheet of metal of 45 degrees. Therefore, a signal that's sent up the tower, in other words, you've got a parabolic dish at the bottom of the tower, aimed straight up. It's called the illuminator. It sends a parallel beam small beam of energy up to the fly swatter at a 45 degree elevation angle that bends at 90 degrees the signal and sends it straight out to the horizon. That's an extremely high performance antenna called periscope antenna, fly swatter antenna. It's got lots of names. And this additional device that you've got in between sounds to me like a so-called frequency selective surface. So now you can make your periscope antenna only respond to a very narrow band group of frequencies by way of that frequency selective planar sheet of metal with step and repeat holes or crosses or triangles or whatever, some kind of shape of apertures in that sheet of metal can make it a frequency selective surface. The nice thing about a periscope antenna, let me drop it, that if you had, for instance, a 200 foot high tower and the fly swatter is now 200 feet off the ground, no transmission line required to go up that tower. If you sent X-band waveguide, for instance, up that tower, with the X-band waveguide has got a loss of 4.5 dB per foot when it's brand new and it's a shiny silver plate, it's a copper with dry nitrogen fill in the waveguide. The best waveguide you're going to get is 4.5 dB per 100 feet at 10 gigahertz. So 200 feet of it would have 9 dB of loss. This beam waveguide that's being used by the periscope antenna system doesn't have 9 dB of loss. It's got 0.5 dB of gain. And by again, the transmission line has, in some cases, 0.5 dB of gain. How do you get gain out of a transmission line? Well, if you've done a real good job of designing that system, parabolic dish illuminator at the bottom is giving such a beautiful illumination taper of energy across the surface of the fly swatter that the fly swatter ends up running at a higher efficiency than if you have the exact same size dish mounted at the top of the tower. So a periscope antenna system, at one time they were very popular because they are so efficient. Let me drop it. The only reason they became unpopular, and Microflect is the name of the company, was a very large manufacturer of these things. Microflect catalog, it's got some beautiful curves and pictures and whatever in there. They became unpopular because in those days, with terrestrial communication and the frequencies being used by satellite were essentially the same frequencies. Therefore, the illuminating dish on the ground aimed straight up, any of that signal that missed the fly swatter was going straight up and hitting somebody's satellite. So that was one of the reasons they became a little bit unpopular. Now that we've got more frequencies to be used, less of that problem, I think it's time the periscope antenna systems should come back into use. That almost everything is being done with fiber optics. Fiber optics gives you a lot more bandwidth, a lot less cost, and you get more bang for the dollar. But if RF linking, microwave links, were still popular today, I think periscope antennas should be used. This sheet of metal with holes in it that you described in between the dish and the fly swatter, is it possible that that was a kind of spatial filter which is called a frequency selective surface? Is that what you were describing, Eric? KETKQIIW?
Okay. It's that, but it also exhibits gain by a double convex trunk of
lots
up and down.
Yeah.
I think they were,
yeah,
they were actually one that told me that it actually gives something like 6 or 7
feet. It does sound like a kind of a lens. Now, in the best of all worlds, the illuminating dish should be nice and large in diameter, which gives you a focused beam, fly swatter, and the fly swatter is really a very, very gentle.
Oh, one thing I forgot to mention, and that is compliments of the shape height that can make a little bit of a shallow addition.
Where was that installation? That is an unusual sounding installation. Where was that one, Eric? Go ahead.
One of those places where they made, like that, just on the west plant in the general.
How long ago did you see that, Eric? Is it still there?
Oh, I doubt it. 4 gigs, of course. Probably 15.
Make a guess, Eric. How tall was the tower? How big was the fly swatter? How big was the dish? Make a rough guess. Go ahead. So I'm going to guess the dish is 6 meters, 18, 19 feet in diameter. The fly swatter probably...
Now let's make
anything in fluid.
Okay, 12, 13 feet in diameter. And the fly swatter had a roughly equal amount of surface area to it, projected area to it, Eric?
I would probably guess.
Okay. Therefore, because the fly swatter was bigger than the dish, that means the dish is quasi-point source, as if it was a very elaborate feed horn. Therefore, the fly swatter should have a very gentle parabolic shape to it with maximum gain. However, to be of difficulty of making the fly swatter parabolic, I'm putting the right kind of a double convex lens in between, and that's what I think you're describing. That lens gave you a front such that the fly swatter acted like it's parabolic even though it was planar. That's a bunch of guesses on my part. Sounds like a rather nice, probably computer-aided design. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
That sounds about right, Dick. That's how
I think they grabbed a long time ago. But the guys would do that.
12% tower? He didn't say, but I'm going to guess it was close to 200 feet. What do you think, Eric?
My tower is 297 feet. Very big.
That explains it. 300 or 400 feet high, you're now getting a very long beam waveguide lens. Therefore, you're getting a certain amount of predictable dispersion of that beam starting to spread out. I mean, you can never make a beam thoroughly collimated unless you've got an infinite size emitter. So, therefore, they had this intermediate lens structure to refocus the beam so the severity of it hits that fly swatter. Sounds like a very nice... Now, when it comes to a periscope antenna system, I have been dreaming about one of those for lots of years. I'm right now in the process of very slowly producing one. I'm going to be using it on 10 gigahertz. As I get back on 10 gigahertz from my QTH in about a year or two, the steering will take place. First of all, the fly swatter in my case will be articulated. In other words, the fly swatter will be mounted on a gimbal structure side of my Rhone 55 tower, such that it can be steered in azimuth and elevation. Therefore, to some degree, I can aim that beam coming out of the periscope antenna system almost anywhere in the upper hemisphere above the Earth. Over to you, Eric. Can you rally to me?
That's good. So, is your azimuth going to be restricted to 20 degrees? Like a ring that goes around the antenna tower?
The fly swatter is going to be offset to one side of the tower. It's mounted on a gimbal structure that allows the fly swatter to be steered in azimuth and elevation. Elevation is going to be a TVRO actuator. Azimuth is going to be by way of a prop pitch rotator, an emboling structure that really supports the fly swatter. And it will sit off to one side of the tower, as will the illuminating dish off one side of the tower. Azimuth-wise, it'll cover 360 degrees in azimuth. And yes, some of those directions will be aimed through the tower. At X-band, my tower is 90% transparent, and through the tower direction, southeast, where there are very few hands out there in the Atlantic Ocean. So although the beam will be distorted by the tower to the southeast, it will have the ability to transmit through the tower. Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
Very cool. Well, actually, the satellite that I look at is right mid-center of the tower. So how far is the arm going to stick out, and how big is this reflection?
The reflector that I already owned was a fly swatter of a periscope antenna system that had been abandoned, and I acquired it. 10 foot wide, 12 foot long, and the dish that feeds it is going to be a 12 foot diameter dish. Over to you, Eric.
Putting some offset load on your tower, how are you going to deal with it?
Yes. My television receive only terminal antenna, 1985 up until 2012, was offset from the side of a tower. So with the right kind of guying structure and balancing structures and whatever, the fact that the structure sits off to one side of the tower, as long as it has separate guys to stop any torsion on the tower from side loading of wind, the fact that the tower is loaded off to one side, there's lots of ways you can negate that. Eric, go ahead.
8x12. Nice big flat sail of them.
This was a commercially made fly swatter antenna. The reflector is made out of expanded aluminum. The system was originally used on, I think, 4 gigahertz. Expanded aluminum, the mesh is fine enough in size and thick enough that the amount of feed to energy at X-band is going to be 15 or 20 dB down. So the nice thing about this thing is that, yes, the wind can go through it. And another nice thing about an articulated periscope system is that in a high wind, the fly swatter parallel to the ground. On a snowy day, you make the fly swatter perpendicular to the ground. Over to you, Eric, KTLIW.
Good. Weather station,
155. That's going to be manufactured. It's made out of aluminum tubing. Lots of kinds of aluminum tubing. Telescoping pieces of tubing acting as a bearing. And on paper, I've already designed that. When it comes to making the fly swatter parallel to the ground on a windy day and perpendicular to the ground on a snowy day, that's only required on a super strong windy day like a Hurricane Sandy. You've done a good enough job of properly guying all this structure, and if you start off with a strong enough tower like Rhone 55, you don't have to do that 95% of the time. And only on super strong windstorms or super strong snowstorms where you've got to take this other corrective action, in my opinion. That is so that it can survive a 20-year event, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Eric, KQLIW.
I did. You know, you've got an actor there that can write something like that real quick. Extra safety is actually some of the corrupted smell, so they don't really want to read it. The question is, you know, it's going to be, you know, you're going to use them.
Oh, multiple arms. The side structure I'm describing is going to be grabbing onto two vertical risers of that tower. And it's also going to have guying like I used on that TVRO dish. I had a TVRO dish sitting at the 60-foot level of my tower for lots of years. And it sat, I'm not sure the exact number, I think it sat 8 feet off to one side of the tower. And the center of gravity of the dish, there was a guy wire that went straight up the tower another 20 feet, so that there wasn't a downward bending moment of that sidearm. And also, from the mounting structure of the dish, there were two separate guy wires going down to the ground to stop any possible torsion on the tower due to side winds, if you know what I mean. So I had balanced everything for gravity and wind so that it could survive all the structures for all of those years, and it did. And I'm going to be using similar techniques here. Back to you for any other questions, Eric. KQLIW.
Actually, a lot of telephones. Actually, what happens is the microwave company, a whole bunch of stuff in the wrong place. Kind of fucking on that.
WS Tom, with a quick question about the dish.
I have one also, Dave.
Okay, the nice thing about this periscope antenna system, Eric, fed by a dish, that I'm designing it for 10 gigs. I wanted to, just by changing the feed horn of the illuminating dish, I know it would work on 2 gigs, 3 gigs, 5 gigs, 10 gigs, 24 gigs, and so on. And as you go up in frequency, as long as the surface accuracies are good enough, the dish has more and more, the periscope antenna system has more and more gain. And so the gain you get out of the periscope, out of the fly swatter, increases. The amount of loss you get going up the tower stays about the same. Cool. The signal going up, the collimated wave going up the side of the tower is called a beam waveguide. It's a very large diameter waveguide with no metal attached to it, if you know what I mean. It's just open air. It's a beautiful system, but it's properly designed. Let's see, we've got Paul and John in that order with questions. Go ahead, Paul, WS2N, and I've got some nice things to tell you when we get over to you. WS2N, K2RAW.
Okay, yeah, Dick. I was wondering if there was any value to these dish antennas. Somebody nearby is throwing out a couple of them. Are they easily convertible to 10 gig or anything useful? I might need it.
How big?
Not the TBROs, but you know, the dish ones, I guess they work with maybe 24 inches. Small ones at dish TVs.
Yeah, the offset fed 18-inch dish for direct satellite reception, direct TV. That is arguably the most popular portable antenna on the 10-gig band, 24-gig band right now, among the guys that do mountaintopping and beachfront operations. So the guys who do portable operations on 10 offset dish is arguably the most popular antenna being used by those guys right now. Back to you, Paul.
What do they do? They change out the low noise detector and a focal point and just hook it up to their ham equipment, you know. You know, they use 2MIF and all, but, you know, my guess is they got to change the preamp and the low noise detector and the focal point. They throw that away and put something else in.
It'll be yes or no. Some guys will build a homebrew feed horn that they substitute for the low noise block down converter that's there. Some guys will readjust the frequency region of the low noise amplifier that's there and use it as the receiver, and then put some kind of a transmit receive relay in there by which they can transmit back through the same horn. So there's at least two approaches on that one, Paul. But those dishes are quite valuable. They're not very expensive. On the surplus market, or even brand new, there was a place at one time that was selling you not with the block converter, just the dish itself. Numbers like $20 at one time because they were being so mass produced. And some of those low noise block down converters, I think in some cases, are selling for numbers like $75. Let's see if Eric knows about that. I bet he does. KE2EW, KE2RIW. KE2RIW,
KE2JU. I'm not saying so much anymore because there's plenty. Well, what are you this kind of died down that day. You don't have any place.
Okay, I think you're saying that the low noise block down converter, which is now made for digital service, is a little bit more expensive. But I think in some cases it's still an 18 diameter offset fed parabolic dish that's doing the bound reception. Isn't that true, Eric? Go ahead.
There still is a pretty market out there, so.
I hear you. John, KC2WGB, for those last couple of questions we've gotten our. Really getting us going. You got it, John.
Two interesting questions. Wow, a lot of information on that. I had one question about your system you were speaking. Have you taken into account the ice loading that you have? And are you going to heat trace element? That ice loading on expanded aluminum is going to be quite heavy.
Now, ice loading, which we only get heavy ice loading that breaks branches of trees, we only get that once every 5 or 10 years or so. In my neighborhood. Yes, there should be some kind of a heater in there. However, a Rhone 55 tower, in theory, can tolerate 55,000 pounds of vertical loading. If you've done a good enough job of balancing offset torques and weights and guying and whatever, probably could be made to tolerate the ice loading. If you were double darn sure, yes, you would weave some insulated wire throughout that ice water in order to melt the ice. However, how much heat would be required, how many watts to melt the ice is an interesting question. At 100 feet in the air, you can get an awful lot of wind loading on top of a 300-foot hill in Huntington. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Yes, Dick, and that's what I was worried about, because as that end of metal apertures close up, the wind weir, and you could have terrific amount of wind loading when that heat trace, which is like 4 watts per foot, and don't need that much of it. Something you want to think of. I think we should go over to Paul before we run out of time. KC2, back to you, Dick.
Hey, John. Paul, the latest issue, the July issue of Scientific American, has two very nice articles. One of them is looks like a 2-page or 3-page article on the subject of the Webb telescope. Says, go big or go home, is the name of the article. It's a Hubble replacement. They got some nice pictures and article about it. And that was on page 14 of the July issue of Scientific American. And on page 26, nice article about New Horizons, entitled Poised for Pluto, which I think is another multi-page article. So, some very nice, easy-to-read articles. And I hope you got some nice technical information out of that thing that I mailed to you from the Applied Physics Laboratory on the subject of the New Horizons spacecraft. In there, I was very excited to see the fact that they rated the cathode of the traveling wave tube good for 200,000 hours. WS2M, our space expert, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul, with I think it's base report number 156.
Very good, 156 it is. And yeah, very good article. I've read all 33 pages. I probably comprehended one third of it. Anything else, you send a PDF, all these satellites, that is always the best information that you can always get. I don't care what, you know, if it's a satellite or a rocket, you know, send PDF on it, click on it, because that's always going to give you a reference amount of information. And I couldn't find that on there how much power the traveling wave tube had. But I found another, I searched another website and did find 12 watts per traveling wave tube. This traveling wave tube amplifier is just located right below the antenna and all, and they can operate together. They can send out circular polarization either right or left, deep space network, and decode it. Very good looking company. So, the beam width and all that, you know, you have to, the different beam widths on the medium gain and the high gain antenna, you know, what it would be like, you know, 58 AU out norm. But, they did talk about the low gain antenna, which is only used out to 1 AU, so that they don't even use anymore. After a year or so, they didn't use that. Now, this thing was launched on an Atlas V, and it was in the 551 configuration. That meant it had five boosters on it. I know I've talked about it before. The fastest object that we've launched off the planet, it weighs about as much as a heavy piano. It's about as big, like a grand piano. Past the orbit of the moon in 9 hours, so got out to Pluto in no time. It's only about 9.5 years. It was launched 2006. For that, they didn't do it this way. They probably would have taken 12 to 14 years, but they lightened the load and sent it out on an Atlas V. That's the most powerful rocket that we have. I don't know if you read it, it came out today that they have had some problems. Here they are, eight days away from the closest point, maybe 7,000, a little over 7,000 miles from the planet. That's how close they're going to get. And they have problems with, apparently, one of the computers malfunctioned. It has, everything's redundant on this thing. Not everything has, but they don't have redundancy in the RTGs, the radioisotope thermoelectric generators that produce a couple hundred watts. But all the other equipment, computers, all kinds of equipment, they have plenty of backup redundancy, and they need it because here they are 8 days away. One of the computers apparently failed for some reason, and it's autonomous, so push over to computer B, and they lost communication with it for some time, and then it made a comeback. The engineers are planning on looking into it, trying to fix things, reverse it, send it back to the original computer. That's the type of thing I would do. Although I'm not an engineer, I kind of like think like what I'd like to, you know, tweak this thing the best I could, but here you got 8 days left. I don't know if that's the best idea. Maybe they should leave well enough alone and leave it on the second computer B. But we'll see. The amount of bits coming back, it was also in that article, 160 bits per second out at almost 39 AU out where Pluto is. That's why it's going to take a month or two to get all the data back, not only pictures, but all the science data. They have a mass spectrometers on there, and they can tell what the atmosphere is made of. They already know now. They use the detector, and they picked up methane. They know that, well, they've confirmed that anyway. At least they know everything works. They knew there's methane there. So all their equipment, the lorry, operate, but Elon Musk did come out with a statement saying that there was some kind of overpressurization of that in the oxygen tank. They have liquid oxygen for the second stage, and also RP-1 rocket propellant, like a kerosene. And they use that in the first stage and the second stage, Falcon 9 two-stage rocket. And at the top of the second stage is the oxygen tank, and then below that is the fuel tank. They think that something with that oxygen tank let loose is something overpressurized, and like really valve went and something failed, or maybe some kind of a fault with the tank itself. But they're looking into it. They have this, they call it, all these tanks are, most of the tanks on the Falcon 9 are monocoque design. It's like a balloon. First stage, well, they have it on the oxygen tank, but they don't have it on the liquid tank. The liquid tank is reinforced. It's a balloon type of tank that they use on the first stage. Both the oxygen and the fuel on the second stage are this monocoque design where, without any kind of pressurization, if they pressurize with helium, or even fill these things up, and that holds the shape of the tank when they run low on fuel, for any reason, if there wasn't any helium to pressurize that, the tank itself would collapse under its own weight. I don't know, maybe something happened there. I always like to try to guess and then see what the end result is. They have a lot of flights on the manifest. They're going to have to work that problem out. And naturally, I haven't heard what the decision is going to be. If they're going to have to change this aluminum, lithium monocoque structure that they built, or if it's something else. Spacecraft, the Dragon itself, apparently was okay. They had telemetry coming from that, but then eventually that disintegrated as well, what I heard. We'll see. Big story, of course, this Pluto flyby that's coming up at the end of next week on Saturday, and we'll have to see what happens. I mean, everything's pointing at Pluto now. There's telescopes of different types looking at it, including they had the Sophia, the telescope mounted in the 747, some jet that they use they have a telescope in the back of it. And that thing had that pointing at Pluto the other day. And Pluto did a transient right in front of a star. Because of that, they used a spectrometer on board the Sophia telescope. They could tell what the planet is made of. Atmosphere, they confirm that there's methane there, and a lot of thought going behind this planetary mission. We'll see. 10 years in the making. Dick, any questions, comments? Back to that WS2N. By the way, anybody wants to contact me, my call letter is WS2N at AR.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Paul, you got right up to